You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Time has come for America to hear the truth about this tragic war. Now, I've chosen to preach about the war in Vietnam today because I agree with Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. There comes a time when silence is betrayal. The truth of these words is beyond doubt, but the mission to which they call us is a most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom. There has never been such a monumental dissent during a war by the American people. Polls reveal that almost 15 million Americans explicitly oppose the war in Vietnam. Additional millions cannot bring themselves around to support it. This reveals that millions have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history. Now, of course, one of the difficulties in speaking out today grows out of the fact that there are those who are seeking to equate dissent with disloyalty. It's a dark day in our nation when high-level authorities will seek to use every method to silence dissent. Something is happening and people are not going to be silent. The truth must be told. And I say that those who are seeking to make it appear that anyone who opposes the war in Vietnam is a fool or a traitor or an enemy of our soldiers is a person who has taken a stand against the best in our tradition. Many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. And so this morning I speak to you on this issue because I am determined to take the gospel seriously. There is at the outset a very obvious an almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched the program broken as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic, destructive suction tube. And you may not know it, my friends, but it is estimated that we spend $500,000 to kill each enemy soldier, while we spend only $53 for each person classified as poor. And much of that $53 goes for salaries to people who are not poor. And so I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and attack it as such. Perhaps the more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population, We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Holland. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schoolroom. So we watch them in brutal solidarity, burning the huts of a poor village. But we realize that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago or Atlanta. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems. And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. America and most of its newspapers applauded me in Montgomery. And I stood before thousands of Negroes getting ready to riot when my home was bombed and said, "We can't do it this way." They applauded us in the sit-in movement. We nonviolently decided to sit in at lunch counters. They applauded us on the freedom rides when we accepted blows without retaliation. Oh, the press was so noble in its applause and so noble in its praise when I was saying, "Be nonviolent toward Bull Connor." There's something strangely inconsistent about a nation and a press that will praise you when you say, "Be nonviolent toward Jim Clark," but will curse and damn you when you say, "Be nonviolent toward little brown Vietnamese children." There's something wrong with that press. Another burden of responsibility was placed upon me in 1964. And I cannot forget that the Nobel Peace Prize was not just something taking place, but it was a commission to work harder than I had ever worked before for the brotherhood of man. This is a calling that takes me beyond national allegiances, but even if it were not present, I would yet have to live with the meaning of my commitment to the ministry of Jesus Christ. To me, the relationship of this ministry to the making of peace is so obvious that I sometimes marvel at those who ask me why I am speaking against the war. Could it be that they do not know that the good news was meant for all men, for communists and capitalists, for their children and ours, for black and white, for revolutionary and conservative? Have they forgotten that my ministry is in obedience to the one who loved his enemies so fully that he died for them? What then can I say to the Viet Cong or to Castro or to Mao as a faithful minister to Jesus Christ? Can I threaten them with death? Or must I not share with them my life? There will be no meaningful solution until some attempt is made to know these people and hear their broken cries. And who are we supporting in Vietnam today? It's a man by the name of General Key, who fought with the French against his own people. and who said on one occasion that the greatest hero of his life is Hitler. This is who we are supporting in Vietnam today. Oh, our government and the press generally won't tell us these things, but God told me to tell you this morning. The truth must be told. And all the while, the people read our leaflets and received regular promises of peace and democracy and land reform. Now they languish under our bombs and consider us not their fellow Vietnamese, the real enemy. They see the children degraded by our soldiers as they beg for food. We have destroyed their two most cherished institutions, the family and the village. We have destroyed their land and their crops. This is a role our nation has taken, the role of those who make peaceful revolutions impossible by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that comes from the immense profits of overseas investment. Now, I'm convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin to shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our present policies. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth with righteous indignation. It will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries, and say this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America and say this is not just. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes and with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. And it is a sad fact that because of comfort, complacency, a morbid fear of communism, our proneness to adjust to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. Our only hope today lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and go out into a sometimes hostile world, declaring eternal hostility to poverty, racism, and militarism. A genuine revolution of values means, in the final analysis, that our loyalties must become ecumenical rather than sectional. Every nation must now develop an overriding loyalty to mankind as a whole in order to preserve the best in their individual societies. This call for a worldwide fellowship that lifts the neighborly concern beyond one's tribe, race, class, and nation is in reality a call for an all-embracing, unconditional love for all men. This oft misunderstood and misinterpreted concept, so readily dismissed by the Nietzsches of the world as a weak and cowardly force, has now become an absolute necessity for the survival of mankind. Let me say finally that I oppose the war in Vietnam because I love America. I speak out against this war, not in anger, but with anxiety and sorrow in my heart, and above all with a passionate desire to see our beloved country stand as the moral example of the world. I speak out against this war because I'm disappointed with America. And there can be no great disappointment where there is no great love. I'm disappointed with our failure to deal positively and forthrightly with the triple evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism. We are presently moving down a dead-end road that can lead to national disaster. America has strayed to the far country of racism and militarism. All men are made in the image of God. All men are brothers. All men are created equal. Every man is an heir to a legacy of dignity and worth. Every man has rights that are neither conferred by nor derived from the state. They are God-given. Out of one blood, God made all men to dwell upon the face of the earth. What a marvelous foundation for any home. What a glorious and healthy place to inhabit. But America strayed away, and this unnatural excursion has brought only confusion and bewilderment. It has left hearts aching with guilt and minds distorted with irrationality. It is time for all people of conscience to call upon America to come back home. Come home, America. I call on Washington today. I call on every man and woman of goodwill all over America today. I call on the young men of America who must make a choice today to take a stand on this issue. Tomorrow may be too late. And don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, "You're too arrogant." Now, it isn't easy to stand up for truth and for justice. Sometimes it means being frustrated. When you tell the truth and take a stand, sometimes it means losing a job. It means being abused and scorned. It may mean having a 7 or 8 year old child asking your daddy, "Why do you have to go to jail so much?" But I've long since learned that to be a follower of Jesus Christ means taking up the cross. And my Bible tells me that Good Friday comes before Easter. Before the crown we wear, there is the cross that we must bear. Let us bear it. Bear it for truth. Bear it for justice. And bear it for peace. Let us go out this morning with that determination. And I have not lost faith. I'm not in despair. I haven't lost faith, because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when the lion and the lamb will lie down together, and every man will sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid, because the words of the Lord have spoken it. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when all over the world we will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last. With this faith, we'll sing it as we are getting ready to sing it now. Men will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And nations will not rise up against nations, neither shall they study war anymore. And I don't know about you, I ain't gonna study war no more.
Just screwed, cause this word is misconstrued. Small countries exempt from food, cause leaders have different views.
You choose. What mean the world to me is being free. Live and let live and just let it be.
Let it be.
Love, peace, and harmony. One universal family. One God, one aim, and one destiny.
Oh yeah. Imagine life without a choice at all. Giving a vote without a voice at all. These be the problems that we face. I'm talking poverty and race. But no matter what the case, we gotta
hold on to this feeling.
Candidate to hate, had to beat on the drum to communicate. For what was to come to those who were hung, they would decapitate the tongue if you would mention the word freedom.
Got people screaming free Bumi and Jamal, but two out of three of y'all will probably be at the mall. I'm heated with y'all, the defeated will fall, incomplete and unsolved when the word freedom's involved.
Yo, my forefathers hung in trees to be free.
Rest in peace.
Got rid of slavery but still kept the penitentiary. And now freedom got a shotgun and shells with your name. Release the hot ones and let freedom ring.
I'm a former boat prisoner, Hollywood visitor. Dance for cats segregated on wax. My color got me handy, Cap, Anus, and Andy. For the freedom they just won't hand me.
So true and it been hurting so long. That's the reason why we named this song. Cause it's not a lot of time. Your heart, body, soul, and your mind. It's so true and it been hurting so long. That's the reason why we named this song.
listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried. This is Black History Month, and that was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. himself. An excerpt from his anti-imperialist speech condemning the war in Vietnam and expressing his staunch opposition to empire and the capitalist system driving it. And even though he gave that speech in 1967, it still resonates today, perhaps more than ever. And of course, we also heard from Jurassic 5 with their song Freedom. Now, to begin this second show of Black History Month, here on Back in the USSR, I'd like to compare Martin's words in his speech on Vietnam with the words of another African-American leader one century before him. This is what Frederick Douglass said in 1852 in The Meaning of July 4th for the Negro. Read an excerpt from it. What, to the American slave, is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him, more than all other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless, your denunciations of tyrants, brass-fronted imprudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour. Go where you may, search where you will, roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world, travel through South America, search out every abuse. And when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation, and you will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival. It was Frederick Douglass speaking in 1859, speaking at a time when slavery was still a major mode of economic production within the context of American capitalism. As American historian, African-American historian Edward E. Baptist made clear in his book, the half has never been told. Slavery played an integral role in capital accumulation in early America. An integral role. With black slave labor producing massive profits for plantation owners, banks, and commercial and industrial interests alike, making millions of Africans work for free from sunup to sundown was a very profitable thing indeed. And that's why so many black people were kidnapped from Africa in the first place and brought halfway around the world to grow cotton, sugar, and other cash crops under the merciless law of the whip and the gun. I mean, consider this. In the span of a single lifetime, after the 1780s and the founding of the American Republic, the American South grew from a narrow coastal strip of worn-out plantations to a subcontinental empire. Entrepreneurial enslavers moved more than 1 million enslaved people by force from the communities that survivors of the slave trade from Africa had built in the South and in the West to vast territories that were seized also by force from their Native American inhabitants. In 1783, at the end of the American Revolution, to 1861, the number of slaves in the United States increased 5 times over. And all this expansion produced a powerful nation, for white enslavers were able to force enslaved African American migrants to pick cotton faster and more efficiently than free people. Their practices rapidly transformed the southern states into the dominant force in the global cotton market. And cotton was the world's most widely traded commodity at the time, as it was the key raw material during the first century of the Industrial Revolution. The returns from cotton monopoly powered the modernization of the rest of the American economy, and by the time of the Civil War, the United States had become the second nation to undergo large-scale industrialization. In fact, slavery's expansion shaped every crucial aspect of the economy and politics of the new nation, not only increasing its power and size, but also eventually dividing U.S. politics, differentiating regional identities and interests, and helping to make civil war possible. That's the context in which Frederick Douglass and the other heroes of the abolitionist cause were writing. And I want to be clear. I want to be very clear on this, lest some people think Canada had no part in this history of profitable enslavement. The history of slavery in Canada spanned two centuries. In what was New France and then Lower Canada under British rule, Canada was involved in the transatlantic slave trade. Within the country's borders, people were bought, sold, and enslaved. Canada was further linked to the institution of enslavement through international trade. The country exchanged products such as salted cod and timber for slave-produced goods such as rum, molasses, tobacco, and sugar from slave-holding colonies in the Caribbean. Black people were kept captive by people of all classes, from governors to priests to blacksmiths to tailors, and from figures such as Canada's first Prime Minister, John A. Macdonald, to James McGill, the founder of McGill University, one of Canada's top universities. While slave ownership filled a need for cheap labor, it was also considered part of an individual's personal wealth. The law enforced and maintained enslavement through legal contracts and detailed transactions of the buying, selling, or hiring out of enslaved persons, as well as the terms of wills in which enslaved people were passed on to others as chattel. They had no basic rights or freedoms, and they were either treated humanely or cruelly depending on their slave master. French and English colonies depended on slave labor for economic growth. The intention of enslaving black people was to exploit their labor. Colonists wanted free labor to increase their personal wealth and, in turn, enhance local and colonial economies. In Canada, the majority of enslaved people worked as domestic servants in households, cooking and cleaning, and taking care of their owners' children. Many were employed in the businesses of their owners, including, for example, inns, taverns, mills, and butcher shops. Enslaved black people cleared land, chopped wood, built log homes, and made furniture in the colonies. As agricultural workers, they prepared fields, planted and harvested crops, and tended to livestock. Many also worked as hunters, voyageurs, sailors, miners, laundresses, printing press operators, fishermen, dock workers, seamstresses, hairdressers, and even as executioners. Slave labor was used to make a range of products such as potash, soap, bricks, candles, sails, and ropes. Enslaved males were trained and employed in skilled trades such as blacksmiths, carpenters, cobblers, wainwrights, and coopers. They were often hired out as a way for slave owners to earn more money on their investment. Enslaved black people labored long hours, doing physically strenuous tasks, and were always at the beck and call of their masters. Introduced by French colonial settlers in New France in the early 1600s, slavery lasted until it was abolished throughout British North America in 1834. And while it might not have been as integral to the economy as slavery in the southern plantation country was, slavery was still a major driver of economic growth from the time fish caught on the East Coast became the staple of the diet of slaves in the British colonies in the West Indies in the 1600s. The British government in 1790 passed the Imperial Statute of 1790, which allowed the colonial settlers in the U.S. loyal to the British to bring in, quote, Negroes, household furniture, utensils of husbandry or clothing into Canada duty-free. Around 3,000 enslaved men, women, and children of African descent were brought into British North America. By the 1790s, the number of enslaved black people in the Maritimes, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and Prince Edward Island, ranged from 1,200 to 2,000. There were about 300 in Lower Canada, Quebec, and between 500 and 700 in Upper Canada in Ontario. In early Canada, some slave owners held a small number of slaves, while others had more than 20. Father Louis Piette, the priest of Saint-Antoine-sur-Richelieu, Quebec, owned 5 slaves, 1 Indigenous and 4 black. James McGill, member of the Assembly of Lower Canada and founder of McGill University, counted 6 enslaved black persons as part of his property. Boatswain and Jane were both owned by Loyalist widow Catherine Clement in Niagara, where they were advertised for sale in the Niagara Herald in 1802. Noted Deputy Superintendent of the Indian Department, Matthew Elliott, is known to have held at least 60 enslaved black people on his large estate in Fort Malden, Ontario, present-day Amherstburg. British Army officer Sir John Johnson brought 14 black slaves with him to early Canada. Prominent military officer and merchant John Askin bought and sold as many as 23 slaves on both sides of the Detroit River. James Girty traded with and was an interpreter for the indigenous peoples of the Ohio region. He owned at least 3 enslaved black people in Gosfield Township in Essex County, Ontario. One of his slaves, Jack York, was accused of an offense against a white woman and was sentenced to be hanged. However, Jack escaped before the sentence could be carried out. Slave ownership was prevalent among members of the early Upper Canada legislative assemblies as well. 6 of the 16 members of the first Parliament of Upper Canada Legislative Assembly, 1792 to 1796, were slave owners or had family members who owned slaves. John McDonnell, Ephraim Jones, Hazelton Spencer, David William Smith, and Francois Baby all owned slaves, and Philip Dorland's brother Thomas owned 20 slaves. Dorland was replaced in Parliament by a slave owner, Peter Van Alstyne, and the following 6 of the 9 original members of the upper house of the Legislative Council of Upper Canada were also slave owners and were members of slave-holding families. Peter Russell, James Bobby, Alexander Grant Sr., Richard Duncan, Richard Cartwright, and Robert Hamilton. Peter Russell, the first receiver and auditor general of Upper Canada, had a free black man named Pompadour working for him, but Pompadour's wife Peggy and their 3 children, Jupiter, Amy, and Millie, were enslaved by Russell. The following 14 out of 17 members of the second Parliament of the Upper Canada Legislative Assembly, 1797 to 1800, either enslaved black people or were from slave-holding families. David W. Smith, who was serving his second term in the Assembly, was a slaveholder. Thomas Fraser, who owned 4 slaves in the District of Johnston, was the district's first sheriff and came from a Loyalist slaveholding family. Richard Beasley owned several slaves in Hamilton, and Richard Norton Wilkinson was in possession of a black woman and 2 black children. Thomas McKee came from a slaveholding family and enslaved 8 black people himself. Dr. Solomon Jones purchased an 8-year-old black girl from his brother Daniel in 1788, and Timothy Thompson owned a number of enslaved black people in the Midland District. Robert Isaac Day Gray was Upper Canada's first Solicitor General and became a slave owner when his father, Major James Gray, died, leaving him a black woman named Dorinda Baker and her sons Simon and John. Benjamin Hardison owned Chloe Cooley before selling her to Adam Vrooman. Samuel Street and his business partner, Thomas Butler, son of Colonel John Butler of Butler's Rangers, dealt with the sale of many goods, including enslaved people. In 1786, they sold, quote, a Negro wench named Sarah, about 9 years old, to Adam Chrysler for £40. William Fairfield and Edward Jessup Jr. were also from families that enslaved black people. And lastly, Christopher Robinson was from a family that enslaved black people and was also the sponsor of the 1798 bill to authorize and allow persons coming to this province to settle to bring with them their Negro slaves. Though the bill passed the first 3 readings in the Assembly, the Legislative Council tied up the bill until the close of parliamentary session, and in doing so prevented it from becoming law. The introduction of this bill reflected an opposition to the abolition of slavery in the province. Members of Nova Scotia's Legislative Assembly were also slave owners. James Delancey and Major Thomas Barclay, both of whom served in the 6th General Assembly, 1785 to 93, owned 6 and 7 slaves respectively. James Moody, who sat in the 7th General Assembly, 1793 to 99, possessed 8 slaves. John Taylor, who was a sitting member of the 8th General Assembly, 1799 to 1806, held 6 black people in bondage. Just as in America, while the formal system of enslavement in Canada ceased to exist in the 19th century, specifically in 1834, when slavery was officially abolished throughout the British Empire, 184 years later, black people remain policed, monitored, and marginalized by state institutions in Canada. While they make up only 3% of the population, black Canadians represent 10% of the people incarcerated in Canada. So slavery existed in Canada, and racism against black people in this country is still a very real thing. Not that it's much talked about. There's a real tendency in this country to downplay things like racism and racist violence and say that they don't happen here, or they're somehow an American problem. And that's just not true. There's a lot of ignorance about the real history of Canada, and that needs to change. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Let me give you a little faith footnote. Turn to your neighbor, say faith footnote.
Once again, it's the welfare consistently on our jobs. Shouts to the affiliates, man. Puerto Rican production, how we doing?
Continue to spark this. Our black stars shining like Marcus. So far to the left where the fark is. Definitely feel we got enough mileage out of marches. And we give a perspective on community that reaches far deeper than these monsters. So of course I don't give a fuck about their bullshit, subpoenas, fabricated charges. Any signs of justice in this country are simply mirages. Cause freedom and America are not synonymous. The fact they're polar opposites. So I don't wanna hear a word about that Obama shit. Death penalty, he won't abolish it. Ask him about Israeli defiance of Geneva Convention, he won't acknowledge it. Talk to him about Mexico's right to their original land, he'll look at you in astonishment. But if you bring Afghanistan, he'll try to convince you to abominate. Don't tell me he's down with the people because of that ganja shit. Cause imperialism put a black face at the head of American imperialism, part of it. And any illusions of our people's freedom, he now conjures it. Even some of our deepest MCs, the ability to see is on the fist. Some electoral rally go yonder with. Cause these pacifying functions we just don't bother with. It's egregious, he's so facetious, deceiving. Regard of change we can believe in. As he turns a deaf ear on real people grieving. Obama's support comes on the right wing of the Democrats, or where he's at. A warmonger with the same hunger to preemptively attack. White master with his skin that's black. In fact, for rack, hopes to continue this borderless war. Find a kind of hope for the past.
Shouts to everybody. Now, anyway. Yo, East Harlem, the West Open, baby. The Bottoms. Shouts to the PLC, CJRIC, Chairman, Spell Structure. Big Lookout, listen, check. Allow me to sit for a second and commence the rip. Then the shred fragments and bits, all the bullshit they tryna get. We got munitions with banana clips, AK-47s with the winning grip. Derringers with ornate tips to bring retribution for slave ships. The jungle and our hunger brings guerrilla warfare. We are Vietnamese in the tunnel, got you in our crosshairs, it's all fair. Squeeze off and displace air, blow your head clean clear. Bump your shoulders, we are soldiers in dangerous pieces like coaches, we don't care. So yeah, I'll cast the first stone, rock and pebble too. Fuck it, homie, I'll be shot putting boulders at your vestibule. You got your own, not I, neither diplomat nor scholar or Obama. Just a wild motherfucker who wants to bomb me. Palm with sweat to show you how wild the poor people get when the heart with his left to struggle and stress. Deep in his heart, a line is kept like a line. I've slept. I'm so deadly. Check my plan, Ray. I'm so ready to come out. Send me the gun. We'll be right back.
this country by terror, away from the Sioux, the Apache, the Arawak, the Comanche, the Arapaho, the Navajo. Terrorism. We took Africans from their country to build our way of ease and kept them enslaved and living in fear. Terrorism. We bombed Grenada and killed innocent civilians, babies, non-military personnel. We bombed the black civilian community of Panama with stealth bombers and killed unarmed teenagers and toddlers, pregnant mothers and hard-working fathers. We bombed Gaddafi's home and killed his child. Blessed are they who bash your children's head against a rock. We bombed Iraq. We killed unarmed civilians trying to make a living. We bombed a plant in Sudan to pay back for the attack on our embassy. Killed hundreds of hard-working people, mothers and fathers who left home to go that day not knowing that they never get back home. We bombed Hiroshima. We bombed Nagasaki. And we knew far more than the thousands in New York and the Pentagon. And we never batted an eye. Kids playing in the playground, mothers picking up children after school, civilians, not soldiers. People just trying to make it day by day. We have supported state terrorism against the Palestinians and black South Africans, and now we are indignant because the stuff we have done overseas is now brought right back into our own front yard. America's chickens coming home. Begets violence, hatred begets hatred, and terrorism begets terrorism. A white ambassador said that, y'all, not a black militant. Turn back to your neighbor and say, footnote is over. Now, come on back.
Back in the USSR, I'll be back after this short break.
Hi, I'm James Gordon, and you are fortunate enough to be listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
The Alzheimer's Society of Waterloo Wellington is looking for people to help out with their music project. Studies have demonstrated overwhelming evidence of the beneficial effects of music and stimulation on people living with dementia. The Music Project provides a free-of-charge iPod with a personalized playlist to individuals living with dementia. The Alzheimer's Society of Waterloo Wellington is looking for volunteers to help with tech, iPod setup, and creating playlists. They are also looking for folks to donate old iPods, iTunes gift cards, or money. $75 gets an iPod Shuffle, and $150 gets an iPod Touch. Other MP3 players are also welcome. For more information or to get involved, visit alzheimerww.ca/musicproject.
I understand if there is something.
No bumps on this ride, let it glide. With Planet Groove and your funky blues doctor serving you up an audio buffet every Friday at 10 a.m. of blues, rock, funk, and more on CFRU 93.3 FM, baby.
If you have a local business, event, or initiative that you would like to promote, CFRU can help you out. Free public service announcements are available to all not-for-profit events and organizations, while for-profits have the option to choose from an ad package that is competitively priced to give you the highest quality ad at the best deals available. A staff member will guide you through the entire process and ensure that you are pleased with the final result before it is put on air. If you are interested in having an ad or PSA run on our station, please contact outreach at cfru.ca for more information.
You're listening to Back in the USSR. Now, and of course I should say that the music here before the break was The Welfare Poets, Let It Be Known, featuring part of the speech by Reverend Jeremiah Wright. America's Chickens Have Come Home to Roost. Talking about American imperialism. Now, I started the program talking about Martin Luther King, the civil rights leader, anti-war activist, and prime target of the American national security state for his efforts with regard to both these things. And this might be hard to believe for some people today, given how everyone seems to invoke his name and speak words of praise not only in politics, but in the business world as well. I remember hearing one marketing guru using his name in the same sentence as Apple Computers. Remember hearing that once. And this marketing guru comparing him with Apple Computers. It was a bit of a surreal kind of moment. But if you look at the real history of his life and career, it becomes clear just how much of an effort there's been to reduce him from the radical figure that he was, radical opponent, really, of capitalism and American imperialism, and rendering him a harmless icon who can be used to sell products in Super Bowl commercials. And that's basically what the next piece I'm going to play is all about. This is an interview with African-American historian Gerald Horn this past week on the Real News Network. And the title is Ram Trucks Super Bowl Ad Drives Over MLK's Legacy. I think that title says a lot. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's a fusion of capitalist propaganda and postmodern hubris. I'm talking about a controversial Super Bowl ad that superimposed the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. over a series of images construed to sell a Dodge Ram pickup truck.
If you want to be important, wonderful. If you want to be recognized, wonderful. If you want to be great, wonderful.
The ad has provoked outrage, partly because it appropriates the legacies of King's iconic rhetoric to sell a product, but also because it's an audacious exploitation of Dr. King's legacy to promote capitalism and consumption, two American compulsions he railed against as partly responsible for the ills of American society. Perhaps this ad reveals just how much Dr. King's most radical philosophy has been scrubbed from history, and how far the myth of his life has been divorced from his beliefs. It's a fallacious revisionism made even more pointed by the fact the ad was released just a few months shy of the 50th anniversary of the day Dr. King was gunned down outside his room at a Memphis hotel. That murder by a gunman named James Earl Ray, like his legacy, still resonates today. And to help me clarify the substance of Dr. King's philosophy on the anniversary of this tragic event, and how it applies to many of the most vexing issues we face today, is a scholar who understands the subject matter intimately, Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. His research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations, including labor, politics, and civil rights. Dr. Horn, before we talk about the assassination, I have to ask you about this ad. I reread the sermon that it's excerpted from, which is known as the Drummaker Speech. It's really a speech about humility and, to a certain extent, the destructiveness of consumer culture. In fact, in the speech, Dr. King talks about buying a car that you can't afford as a sign of spiritual distress. Now, last time I checked, a Dodge Ram costs in excess of $50,000. Is this tone deaf? Is this another symptom of his image being sanitized for white America?
I do think it's another example of this image being sanitized. However, we should not be shocked nor surprised. Keep in mind that just before Martin Luther King was assassinated in April 1968, his popularity was not necessarily sky high, at least outside of the non-black community. And this reveals another disturbing aspect of this entire tawdry episode. That is to say, it has become commonplace nowadays for men like Dr. King to be excoriated by the corporate media and yes. others who believe in the corporate media while they're alive. And then after they're safely tucked away in their coffin in a grave, then their images are refashioned to somehow either support corporate capitalism or undermine those who are opposed to corporate capitalism. This is what's going on today. And then, of course, we should ask the unavoidable question, which is, how did the estate of Martin Luther King come to authorize this ad? Right. Keep in mind that the estate of Dr. King holds his image dear. It's very difficult oftentimes for scholars to quote his words. And yet, we see this corporation